on my groove. Walking on me on, so glad you came along.
Summer is a season defined by convention in meteorology as the whole months of June, July, and August in the Northern Hemisphere, and the whole months of December, January, and February in the Southern Hemisphere. In some Western countries, the first day of summer in the Northern Hemisphere falls either on or around June 21st or on June 1st. The former is the astronomical storm, the latter the meteorological.
Summer is commonly viewed as the season with the longest and warmest days of the year, in which the daylight predominates through varying degrees.
In the northern latitudes, twilight is known to last at least an hour, sometimes leading to the famous White Nights found in St. Petersburg in Scandinavia.
It is also the season of the midnight sun near the North Pole, in Iceland, for instance.
For many people in the West, the seasons are considered to start at the equinoxes and solstices in an astronomical sense. However, due to the phenomenon of seasonal lag, the meteorological start of the season precedes by about 3 weeks the astronomical season.
However, due to the phenomenon of seasonal lag, the meteorological start of the season precedes, by about 3 weeks, the astronomical season.
This time differential keeps the meteorological definition more symmetrically centered around the warmest part of the year than the astronomical one is.
Today, the meteorological definition is most common,
but in the past,
the astronomical definition was more frequent.
And some people today still prefer it. Elsewhere, however, the solstices and the equinoxes are taken to mark the midpoints, not the beginning of the seasons. In Chinese astronomy, for example, summer starts on or around May 6th. In southern and southeast Asia, where the monsoon occurs, summer is more generally defined as March to May or early June, their warmest time of year, ending with the onset of the monsoon rains. In most countries, children are out of school during this time of year, although dates vary. Some begin as early as mid-May, although in the UK, from the ages of 5 to 16, school ends in the middle of July. Summer is also the season in which many fruits, vegetables, and other plants are in full growth. Summer temperatures call for preventative measures, drinking plenty of water, carrying a hat when you are in the sun, and avoiding direct rays wherever possible. But there are plenty of summer myths circulating out there, too.
Unfortunately, Mom wasn't always right,
says Dr. Edward Schwartz, medical officer for Schaller Anderson.
Some of the summer myths we grew up believing were old wives' tales, and some were the prevailing thought at the time.
He and other healthcare experts at Schaller Anderson, a nationwide health management company headquartered in Phoenix, offer these tips for surviving the summer heat. Myth 1. Sunburns fade into tans.
Truth.
Burned skin will not miraculously fade into tan. It will result in skin damage, redness, and eventual peeling. Any amount of sun exposure poses an increased risk for skin cancers and premature aging. But sunburn poses an even stronger risk. Myth 2. Everyone should drink 8 glasses of water a day.
Truth.
Everyone should hydrate, but the amount of water varies depending on the age, size, and physical activity of the drinker. If you have risk factors for dehydration, such as an illness with fever or prolonged exercise in hot weather, take in extra water and salt. For most of us, if you drink water regularly through the day, eat a balanced diet, and feel generally well, you probably are getting just the right amount of water. Myth 3. Wait an hour before eating or... Myth 3. Wait an hour after eating before swimming. There are no documented cases of anyone drowning after swimming on a full stomach. Digestion takes blood flow away from muscles, which could make any exercise more difficult. It might be harder to remove yourself from a strong undertow in the ocean or a river, but if you are in a home swimming pool, you should be able to get out of the water if you have cramps. Myth 4. Freckles that become apparent in the summer sun are signs of skin cancer. Freckles can be an indication of skin that has been damaged by the sun, but are not among the warning signs for skin cancer. Using a sunscreen with a high sun protection factor can help. Moles that change color or look different are a warning sign for skin cancer, but exposure to the sun will not cause those moles to change color. Myth 5. Dark-skinned people don't need sunscreen. Lighter-skinned people may be more sensitive to the ultraviolet rays from the sun, but everyone is susceptible to the damaging effects of the summer sun. People with lighter skins have less melanin, the pigment that absorbs UV radiation and protects skin. While light-skinned people will be very sensitive to UV rays, those with darker skins can still be affected. The American Academy of Dermatology recommends routine sunscreen with an SPF of at least 15 for dark-skinned people. Myth 6. Butter will cool a burn.
That's a summer myth. Butter? People are putting butter on a sunburn?
Butter can make an open wound even worse. A better solution is to run cold water over the burned area before applying an ointment. It's not wise to place ice or other frozen objects directly on the burn. The extreme cold can cause its own damage. Use a cloth or other barrier between the ice and skin to get the benefits of cooling without causing further damage. For more severe burns that cause blistering or loss of feeling in the burned area, see your doctor.
Looking for the perfect tan? Don't expose your skin to UV rays from the sun or tanning bed. Get your tan to go today. As school-age children begin their summer vacation, many parents urge them to get extra short haircuts for the hot months ahead. For those parents who receive resistance to this idea, science offers several reasons to back them up. Researchers who study the biology of hair suggest a few advantages,
from a scientific point of view,
of a short summer haircut.
Less hair keeps the head cool.
People can lose up to 50% of their body heat from the top of their head. That's why it's important for everyone to wear hats and earmuffs during the winter months. But when we don't want to get overheated, having less hair can make it easier for that heat to escape the head. Thick, overlapping layers of hair insulate the scalp, says Desmond Tobin of Bradford University in England. Short hair will reduce this during hot weather, he says. Things get even better if the hair is not totally flat. Curly hair, such as an afro, is raised above the scalp and can actually permit wind eddies to cool the head.
Hair grows slightly faster in hot months, suggests at least one study.
A 1991 article in the British Journal of Dermatology explored androgen-dependent hair growth in bald men living in temperate climates. Androgen-dependent hair includes some scalp hair and other hair whose growth is influenced by hormones called androgens. The study suggested that androgen-dependent hair growth is faster during the spring and summer months and slower during the winter months in temperate regions. Although this study was conducted in men, the results may also apply to women. One caveat, however, is that the results may not apply to children since their hormonal activity is very different from adults, at least before puberty.
Scalp hair grows up to 0.45 millimeters a day.
This daily rate translates to about half an inch per month. Shorter hair makes it easier to spot ticks on the scalp, which is important for some areas with the prevalence of Lyme disease.
On the negative side.
Shorter hair, especially for those with lighter hair, receives more exposure to potentially damaging UV radiation during the summer months. Thicker hair may reduce the amount of UV hitting the scalp, as suggested by the existence of UV-induced scalp problems in bald men. Hair does a very good job of blocking UV. It will block ultraviolet rays from reaching the scalp skin as well, if not better, than sunscreen. Thus, hair that is kept very short, for example a buzz cut, will permit UV to gain more access to the scalp. For those with short haircuts, avoiding the direct sun and wearing light-colored hats is still the best way to prevent UV radiation from hitting the scalp. Is it about summer that occasions the shameless abandonment of propriety and taste? The tube top, the plastic jelly shoe, and the Daisy Duke jean short all owe their existence to our seasonal lack of discrimination. Only in the summer do grown and usually well-dressed women don such juvenile and unflattering styles. Only in the summer do professional and otherwise passably attired men dress as though preparing to clean out the garage. If you have left your home in the past few weeks, you have no doubt witnessed some of the season's more common missteps. Exposed bra straps, bare bulging midriffs, bad sandals. And you may have asked yourself why the first warm days of the year are like a Halloween costume party, a chance for people to wear whatever, or however little, they desire. After many such alarming sightings, I set out to catalog the worst summer fashion faux pas. Most egregious blunders arise from improper underwear. Most women despair of finding lingerie to suit the season's skimpy styles and diaphanous fabrics, and many don't bother to try.
I just have a glass of wine and get over it,
says one woman in an article lamenting the death of summer bra possibilities. And so bra straps overwhelm. Delicate spaghetti strap tank tops, a stylistic faux pas that has become almost admissible. Floral and black lace panties wink from beneath tight white jeans and slacks. And, in the harsh light of the sun, even plain white undies emit an eerie, spectral glow, as though the wearer were concealing a black light in her pants. With summer whites, wear only flesh-toned underthings, but remember that flesh-toned does not mean invisible.
No, it don't.
It don't mean invisible.
Invisible.
It don't mean invisible.
Invisible. It might seem that such errors stem from either a perverse exhibitionism or a stubborn refusal to buy tasteful underwear. But it may be that for many women, summer is synonymous with childhood. Body consciousness and strapless bras are not readily incorporated into a lexicon formed during years when bare feet and Kool-Aid wings were the ne plus ultra of chic. And to acknowledge that miniskirts and halter tops don't hang like they used to is to admit the passage of time. Denial may explain the adult woman's penchant for adolescent fashions, like last year's flounced cheerleading skirts and other girlish costumes. Maritime-inspired attire that evokes Shirley Temple's sailor suits. Shirts tied in the front, a la Marianne on Gilligan's Island, and most infantile of all, the miniature short shorts, which at their smallest often measure a mere 5 inches from waist to hem. As Kennedy Frazier wrote in The New Yorker in 1971, shorts have their element of fantasy, since the woman who wears them must not mind looking like a child of 10. At the time of Frazier's essay, shorts, then
hot pants,
were enjoying a rare fashionable moment. But for most of their history, shorts have remained a signifier of serious joggers, unstylish suburbanites, and conspicuous Americans abroad. They are the C-list celebrity of summer fashion, maligned yet ubiquitous. Recently, however, tastemakers have declared that the ultimate summer faux pas is once again cool. Both Vogue and Elle have recently displayed shorts in their pages. These items are either the size of table napkins or long, skinny columns designed for the 12 living women with pipe cleaner thighs. In Vogue's April Shape issue, a photo spread featuring 90-pound gazelles lounging in shorts reads,
"As the days grow longer, trouser lengths get shorter. It's a great look, especially for the sleight of frame."
For both sexes, but especially for men, the dog days of summer present the conundrum of summer footwear. Few styles garner more vitriol, in conversation and in print, than sandals for men, sometimes called man sandals, or mandals, or mandals, or mandals. It might be best to avoid the sandal trap altogether and choose an inoffensive pair of sneakers. But if you are a man who chooses to wear sandals, be aware that the person staring at the ground may actually be glaring at your feet, and leave your socks at home, particularly if they are the same dark ones you wear to the office, a place, by the way, where sandals should never be worn. As for flip-flops, the sandals' plastic cousin, these are office-appropriate only if your co-workers don't mind that you sound like a metronome as you walk. But with barely an inch between the wearer's feet and filthy city or suburban streets, flip-flops can be a health hazard. A friend gave them up after an audacious rat scuttled over her exposed foot. In Slouching Towards Bethlehem, Joan Didion recounts a sartorial gaffe of this stripe.
What in the hell does that mean?
After a morning spent with her daughter in the sprinkler, she heads to the supermarket in her bikini. Her outfit infuriates a large woman in a cotton muumuu, who, heedless of the fact that people in muumuus shouldn't throw stones, engages in a kind of supermarket road rage, following Didion throughout the store, repeatedly ramming into her cart while hissing,
"What a thing to wear to the market!"
This story cuts to the heart of almost any summer fashion faux pas. They are all, in a sense, a case of wearing your bikini to the supermarket. For most of us, summer means intimations of childhood lost, less time spent in the cubicle or the classroom, and more at the pool, the beach, or running through the sprinkler. It's no wonder, then, that when we re-enter the adult world, we want to bring a bit of summer, however symbolic, back with us. But to avoid arousing the aesthetic indignation of your colleagues, neighbors, or fellow shoppers, try returning with a tan, say, or a little sand in a jar, and leave the bare chests, bikinis, and flip-flops where they belong.
What a thing to wear to the market! What a thing to wear to the market! What a thing to wear to the market!
What a thing to wear to the market!
Teenager's Guide to the Steamiest
and Easiest
Summer Jobs. A summer job doesn't have to stink. Just listen to my advice. I have compiled and judged the most popular summer jobs available to high school students. Every single one of these jobs is attainable. You don't need work experience or parental connections or a high school diploma to get it. I've evaluated the jobs according to the factors that matter most to Generation Y: wages, availability, and last but not least, the hookup factor. The hookup factor. The hookup factor. Let's look at the list of jobs now.
Fun.
Job. Burger flipper / cappuccino maker / burrito roller. They say you learn how to be part of a team, flip burgers, etc. You really learn how to mindlessly obey corporate dogma and or spit in other people's food. Upside, free chalupas! Downside, to quote Fast Food Nation, there is something unpleasant in the meat. Wages, $5.50 to $8 an hour. Minimum age, 14, although most places start at 16. How do I get this job? Spend a Sunday in May at a food court or a rest stop filling out all the applications. Hookup factor, very low. Cheap, garish visors do not qualify as a turn-on. Job. Supermarket worker bee. They say you learn how to bag groceries, stock shelves, and work a cash register. You really learn how to drive motorized wheelchair shopping carts. Upside, air conditioning 24/7, and the fact that the job requires absolutely no thinking or effort. Downside, no time to sit down, and the fact that the job requires absolutely no thinking or effort. Wages, $6 to $10 an hour. Minimum age, 14 for baggers, 16 for everyone else. How do I get this job? Start nagging your local supermarkets and drugstores in March.
hookup factor
low. There are two problems. A, writing your phone number on grocery store receipts is a bit too cheesy for most to pull off. And B, if you're a bagger, the only people you'd have time to flirt with are the people who are buying lots of groceries. That is, moms and dads with minivans and toddlers.
Job.
Busboy, waiter, or hostess at a mid-priced restaurant.
They say you'll learn how to
interact with people, read a wine list, and serve food.
You really learn how to
make house dressing out of mayonnaise and assorted other condiments, furtively sweep up shards of the plate you dropped.
Upside,
surely TGI Fridays doesn't need all that Dr. Pepper on tap.
Downside,
you have to choose between day shifts, when no one comes in and you get no tips, and night shifts, where you'll miss out on all your prime chances for
young, wholesome fun
while hanging out with your friends.
Wages.
Hostesses make between $6.50 and $10 an hour. Waiters are tip-dependent. A night shift can garner anywhere between $50 and $120. Day shifts are less lucrative. Busboys usually make less than the waiters, unless they are working the bar, where you sometimes get a portion of the bartender's tips.
Minimum age?
14. But at most restaurants, you need to be at least 16 to be a waiter or a hostess.
How do I get this job?
Something called the Yellow Pages, and the ability to lie brazenly about past experience in the business.
Hookup factor.
High if you're a hostess or waitress wearing a tight shirt. Moderate if you're a waiter with a modicum of charm. Low if you're a 15-year-old busboy who has to wear a goofy Hawaiian shirt. Trust me, I know from experience.
Job.
Lifeguard.
They say you learn how to
give CPR, save lives.
You really learn how to
use sunglasses to cover up the fact that you're sleeping on the job, and, if you're physically gifted, make skimming the pool look like it's an enviable task.
Upside,
skin.
Downside,
sunburn.
Wages,
$6.50 to $9 an hour.
Minimum age,
15.
How do I get this job?
Take a certification course during the winter at your local YMCA or JCC. Then start calling country clubs, apartment complexes, and summer camps.
Hookup factor?
Moderate. It all depends on where you work. Big neighborhood or country club pools can be a bonanza, or so I've heard. On the other hand, if you pick the wrong place, say the YMCA, you'll be subject to a daily visual diet of only the very young taking swimming lessons and the very old doing water aerobics.
Job.
Telemarketer.
They say you learn how to
telemarket.
You really learn how to
annoy the hell out of people in a professional manner.
Upside.
Nice desk, your own phone, flexible hours, relatively high pay, and little stress.
Downside.
You're a telemarketer.
Wages.
$9 to $15 per hour, plus commissions.
Minimum age.
Some places will hire students as young as 14, although 16 and 18 is much more common.
How do I get this job?
Check want ads in free employment newspapers. The phone book is also a decent resource. However, it would be quicker to find people a couple years older than you who have telemarketed before and can give you leads.
Hookup factor.
Low. No one likes telemarketers. Plus,
would you like to refinance your mortgage?
Does not qualify as a pickup line.
Job.
Worker B at a quaint guitar repair center, thrift store, secondhand bookshop, etc., etc.
They say you learn how to
manage a small business, other assorted skills.
You really learn how to
sit in a corner and read, other assorted skills.
Upside,
peace, quiet, and quirkiness.
Downside,
there is such a thing as too much peace, quiet, and quirkiness. Think of Canada.
Wages,
$6 to $9 per hour.
Minimum age,
14.
How do I get this job?
Wander around stores until you hit the jackpot, or work the phones for a couple of hours.
Hookup factor?
Low. Even if you're cute, these places usually have low traffic. However, if you manage to obtain a significant other over the summer, your workdays will be rife with opportunities for a little bit of
young, wholesome fun.
Job.
Sales assistant at a music or book megastore.
They say you learn how to
interact with customers, maximize product placement, get acquainted with shipping software.
You really learn how to
get depressed by the fact that so many people are buying Avril Lavigne albums at full price.
Upside,
shelves of books, shelves of music.
Downside,
suburbanites who think they're literary now that there's a Barnes & Noble with a cappuccino bar near their McMansion's enclave. The old lady who repeatedly comes into the store to ask if her favorite novel is still out of print.
Wages,
$7 to $10 an hour.
minimum age 16. How do I get this job?
Fill out applications and cross your fingers. Do not mention your love of alt rock in the interview. Do look the part of fresh-faced suburbanite by wearing Banana Republic or Gap or J.Crew or Abercrombie and Fitch or blah, blah, blah.
Hookup factor,
moderate. Helpfulness, charm, and a little nerdiness might catch the eye of like-minded bookworms or record heads. If you have a thing for mall rats, you can always check the in-store cafe after your shift ends.
Job,
construction worker.
They say you learn how to
build stuff.
You really learn how to
look manly.
Upside,
power tools and dangerous machinery.
Downside,
power tools and dangerous machinery.
Wages,
$8 to $13 per hour.
Minimum age, 16,
although it's usually 18.
How do I get this job?
Phone book,
or
by pestering the guys who are fixing up your school.
Hookup factor,
high. The combination of rugged work, taut muscles, tight-fitting undershirts, a tan, and really cool lunchboxes can elicit
verdant adoration.
Job.
Landscaper, groundskeeper.
They say you learn how to
maintain grass, trim hedges, repair fences.
You really learn how to
play poker on lunch breaks and drive a tractor.
Upside,
lawnmower fights.
Downside,
muddy fields, the possibility of literally getting a redneck and grass rash.
Wages,
$7 to $10.
Minimum age,
16, although some places will hire 14-year-olds.
How do I get this job?
Local park services often hire summer help. Also, keep a lookout for want ads.
Hookup factor,
high for females, low for males. Even for those of us who aren't denizens of NASCAR Nation, there's a certain allure to tractor-driving women. On the other hand, there's not much of a market for guys who smell like fertilizer. When the city becomes a giant convection oven is smell season. So its opening day, coming as it did earlier this spring before the recent cold snap, was something of a surprise. The mercury shot
up above 80.
And all across the city, long dormant stenches began to stir, reminding New Yorkers that it will soon be time to employ their preferred odor avoidance techniques. Nose holding, mouth breathing, the strategic sniffing of a packet of mints. Last year, POTUS, an Israeli company, began marketing a clear gel called Odor Screen. Ilan Schatz, one of POTUS's founders, had been in New York on business shortly after 9-1-1 and heard that recovery workers were complaining about the terrible smell at Ground Zero. Some workers had taken to spreading Vicks VapoRub under their noses. Odor Screen is applied in a similar fashion, but rather than mask odors, as air fresheners and perfumes do, it temporarily alters the smell receptors in the nose, so the user perceives only the soothing scent of vanilla, or, in Asian markets, green tea. POTUS is considering culture-specific Odor Screen formulas. One of POTUS's first clients was Zaka, the Israeli group that recovers bodies and body parts at the sites of accidents and bombings. This winter, after the tsunami in Asia, POTUS distributed Odor Screen packets to relief workers there. These are far graver situations, surely, than the olfactory hazards of summer in the city. But POTUS envisions consumer applications for Odor Screen, too. And New York is high on the company's list of stinky targets.
Target Markets. Will it make it here? On that first smelly day, an independent expert was called in. Rich Anderson, a city sanitation worker from Bay Ridge, who spends his days picking up the garbage of Hell's Kitchen in Chelsea, agreed to give Odor Screen a whirl during his off hours. The first stop was the Fulton Fish Market.
It should be pretty nasty right now,
he said as he sat in his car applying the gel. A pine tree-shaped air freshener dangled from the rearview mirror. Anderson, who has a sturdy-looking nose, reviewed his olfactory biography. Earliest smell memory, the bakeries of Bay Ridge on Sunday mornings. Pet peeve, freshly applied asphalt.
Man, that stuff stinks.
He stepped outside. The market was closed for the day, but a fishiness lingered.
They clean this place up and they hose it down, but you can never get that smell out,
Anderson said. He approached some pallets.
All the fish guts soak into the wood,
he said. He bent over a pallet and began to sniff. A security guard came over.
Sanitation, I'm doing a survey,
Anderson said with authority, and the guard retreated. Anderson bent down again, a few more long sniffs, then said,
this stuff works pretty good.
A fishy smell, the smell of Chinese food, garbage, street, stagnant water, he went on.
Everything mixes together, but it's hard to detect now with this stuff on.
He stopped to sniff at a dirty section of drainage pipe under the bridge. An elderly Chinese couple, seated behind a card table, eyed him with suspicion.
I can't smell anything but vanilla,
he said. Anderson arrived at the Gansevoort Meat Market just as a private sanitation truck pulled up. Two workers jumped out and began moving red buckets onto a loader. Ernest Moore, the driver, a wiry, intense man wearing yellow rubber gloves and a gold hoop earring, got out.
We're looking for rotting flesh,
Anderson informed him. Moore grinned fatly.
I got some smelly meat,
he said, gesturing to the truck behind him.
Some days you look inside those barrels and there's nothing but white, creeping and crawling.
He shook his shoulders in imitation of writhing maggots. He took an Odor Screen sample for later use, but he appeared skeptical.
The city doesn't bother me,
he said.
Same smells, different day. You know what I mean?
Winter's almost gone. Oh, I've waited so long for summer night. When there's magic in the air and I don't ever care, all that matters to me.
This has been the EdShep Radio Experiment. Thank you for listening and tune in next week. This is Ed Shep signing off.
You're listening to WFMU East Orange, WXHD Mount Hope, and WFMU.org. Have a great day.
Beep.